Welcome to 99% Geek Presents, an audiobook theater podcast. I'm afraid this is the last audiobook theater podcast I am ever going to produce. My writing will continue to be offered at 99geek.ca, but I came here to give you just one more episode for anyone who's out there, if there is anyone out there. I'm your host and writer behind 99geek.ca, Andrew Getzey, and this is being recorded on Monday, June 28th at 12:09 p.m. My goal in life has always been to write for television, but it's a goal I've had little luck so far in attaining. So instead, I've resorted to self-publishing novels on Amazon. But writing the monthly chapters like episodes of TV shows that people can download at 99geek.ca. Every chapter is released in four parts, a teaser, and three acts, and every month features a different book spanning both science fiction and fantasy and every genre in between. So basically, what that means is that you can go to 99geek.ca, and for free, my writing these each week, each part of the chapter, each act will be there every week for you to read, and you can just read it. And at the end of the month, it gets made as a PDF, and the PDFs are put at the bottom of every single post that's there. So even if like my writing is really buried and all you see is like video game streams, at the bottom of that video game stream will be my PDFs of my writing and stuff, and you can download it there. So you can read it in a PDF form on like your phone or a tablet, or you can print it out and read it on paper. I wouldn't advise that. Save the trees. What are you doing? Read on your computer if you want. I don't care. An ebook reader, I believe that it'll even read on those. Find any way you can to keep reading and following along, and let me know you're out there and review my stuff on Goodreads or whatever you can. And it would mean the world to me. It would do so much to help me out. That's right. I wrote all the books featured on this podcast, and I will continue to write them even after the podcast is done. Trying to make ends meet in what feels like a poverty nightmare. I'm doing all of this alone, living off unemployment insurance. I don't have a budget. I don't have a team. No editors or producers. I have no backup, no support. I'm completely alone, pro bono, with nothing but my passion for telling stories, unless I ask them to judge me or my production or my work or my production values too harshly. I'm doing the best I can, trying to wear all the hats, and that's basically why I'm ending the podcast, because it's just too many hats. It's too many hats. I can't. It's stressing me out too much. Even if there was a period there where I was actually kind of pulling it off and it was working. I think over time my writing has been degrading as like the stress is just really getting to me. And so I can't do this alone and I have no friends because I'm a loser. And I have no I've got nothing. So goodbye podcast. Hello dying alone and miserable. But yeah, so please keep following along my writing. The writing is all I really care about. I love being a writer. I want to write for reels. I want to write for television. I would do anything. But yeah, tonight we'll be reading from phase three of season one of 99% Geek, a chapter of a book entitled Royalty. Remember, you can follow along at 99geek.ca. Chapters are somewhat standalone, but at least make sure you start on week one for the recap. This is not week one, but you know what? I'm going to try to do a recap anyway because it's been a while. This is chapter episode number two of Royalty, entitled On the Road Again. And we continue with week number three. But first, we'll do a recap. Previously, on Royalty Chapter 1, there are few on Caldean who remember a time before the Great Flood, when a powerful alliance of nations ruled the world and had the ability to accomplish anything with magic. There was contentment throughout all the people of Caldean, and from that contentment bred apathy, and through that apathy, inequality grew. Magic became a luxury for only those with power, and an hierarchy developed between the most powerful, the lesser powerful, and everyone else. The strongest began to call themselves royalty. No one knows exactly which royal was the first to make contact with the demons of the lower plane, only that they weren't the last, and it was this tearing of the planar veil that invited with it the violent climate change that rocked Caldean, bringing rising waters and the collapse of civilization. Now only one landmass remained, a vast landscape with Caldean's last remaining forests and fertile land, only patches of which held up against the ravages of the end of the world. It is in those places the powerless of Caldean hide and make their living, praying the day will never come that the higher and lower royals leave their flying nightmare city of Dunkel to cull the remaining villages. One such powerless man, Goldak Bailey, thought he had what it took to rise from his squalor and become one of the haves. He thought he could contend with the likes of the royals and attempted to do business with them. However, when he chose to keep an item he had been tasked to collect from the higher royal Draxia, the demonatrix, she sent lesser royal Marius to return her property. It was a vial of Medusa potion, and one drop of it turned Goldak and his entire camp to stone. His family, Allison Ali Bailey and her father Dermon and brother Ronan, came upon the camp an unspecified amount of time later. Taking their uncle back to their hometown of Westerly to Ali's mother and Goldak's sister, the once traveling warrior woman but since retired mom, Marilyn Lynn Bailey, the two women consulted Ali's large library of books for a cure to Goldak's petrification. They decided together to set off for a distant forest in search of a legendary blue Priscillian flower, not knowing that Draxia had dispatched Marius to hunt down their family and end Goldak's bloodline once and for all. Now, I had a plan that were my podcast to continue, that I would try to do recaps of like the weeks that I had written. Like if it's week two, I would recap week one, and I would do it as such. So since we're going to do week three and four tonight, I think I forgot to mention that earlier, but we are doing week three and four. I'm going through both of them for you guys. And so I'm going to quickly recap week one and two. So in week one, Lynn was sharpening her swords. We're just going to scroll through this. She's sharpening some swords, getting ready for her trip. She decides she doesn't want to take Allie along, but then Allie just makes her because she's all stubborn and stuff and does stubborny things. So then we cut to Marius, and he's in his fortress, and he's all like emo and stuff. And there's this creepy golem thing, and it has a face drawn on it, and it's all like, woo! And he's all like, wah, I'm emo. And then we cut from there to, yes. We cut to the from there to the scene where Allison decides to be all stubborn, and Marilyn says, "Fine, come with me." And Ali says, "Cool, we're gonna go on an awesome adventure. I love my horse." Then in week two, there's Dermon. Now we're in week two, and Dermon is the husband of Lynn, and he's just taking a bath, and he sees the mayor, and she's looking at his penis, and he's like, "Oh shit, stop looking at my penis." And she's like, "Yo, wanna like fucking stuff?" And he's like, "Hey, I'm married and shit." And she's like, "Fuck, well, how about we work together and create a militia to fight against, the royals that did that shit to your uncle, to your wife's brother." So I guess your kid's uncle. He's all like, "Cool, I don't have a choice, do I?" And she's like, "Nope, cool." And then we cut from there to the kid, Ronan, and he's playing around, and there's other kids, and they're all like, "Hey, we're gonna bully you." And one of the kids like, "I don't want to bully you." And Ronan's like, "Want to be friends?" And they're like, "Yeah, let's play ball." And then they played ball with the statue of Goldak, the uncle, who's a statue and is just there. And they're like, "Yay, this is fun. We're kids and stuff." And then it cuts from there, and we're with Lynn, and I forgot to mention earlier that she was hearing weird whispers on the wind, and she's still hearing those weird whispers, and she's like, "What's up with all these whispers?" And then they're like, "Hey, the Ali, what's up?" And Ali's all like, "There's a thing," and she's like, "Cool." And then there's a fork in the road, and the whispers are like, "Go right," and Lynn's like, "I don't trust weird whispers on the wind. I'm gonna go left." So they decided to go left, and that was the end of week two. So yeah, that's the sort of awesome recap awesomeness that you're gonna miss out on because we're not gonna be continuing this podcast. But that was the plan, that I was gonna start doing something like that with every subsequent week after week one, so that people didn't necessarily have to go back if they just wanted to r listen to a specific week. But anyway, so that recap's done and we are caught up. That was the end of week two. Now we're gonna read week three and four. Here we go. Marius awoke slowly to the polished black stone of his master bedroom. Lying atop his black four-post bed, under his black comforter, but over his silk black sheets, he stared out at the chiseled, sculpted wall of his bedroom for minutes that stretched into hours, all while he procrastinated getting up. In his bed, it was like he was safe from it all the responsibilities, the ultimatums, the amorality. If he were to get up, he would be buried beneath the weight of the world, but in his bed, none of that could touch him. He hated getting up. He hated facing the world every day. He hated the world and being in it. His polished black obsidian doors creaked open, and the dark form of Mother Golem stepped slowly into his room with quaking steps. It was carrying a tray in its arms and rumbling mournfully. "I know what time it is," Marius complained, unable to understand Mother Golem, but carrying a conversation anyway. He could tell by the pale dim white glow that the sun was at its highest in the sky. Even on the sunniest of days, the sun's light could barely penetrate the dark aura that surrounded the city of Dunkel. That dim light was about as bright as the flying city ever got. Mother Golem stepped up to the bed, its best attempt at breakfast on the tray between its large boulder-like hands. The eggs were runny and unevenly cooked, mixed in with the now soggy hash browns and unbuttered mashed-up toast. Mother Golem brought it to his face, and he shied away from it with disgust. "I'm not hungry," he assured her, slipping from his bed. As he got out from under the covers and straightened to his feet, his pajamas turned to smoke, and then into his fitted suit and long flowing trench coat-like robe. Mother Golem moaned after him with its whale-like call. "Oh, don't be like that, Mother," he muttered to Mother Golem coldly. "You already know crying will get you nowhere." Mother Golem shuffled away lonesomely. It was an emotion Marius understood well, for he too was alone. An entire massive castle, and it was all just for him. He couldn't imagine feeling more lonely. He stepped out from his black stone cold bedroom, from his black stone bedroom. It's not cold. I mean, it might be cold. Probably cold. He stepped out from his black stone bedroom onto his balcony, looking out at his surrounding land that made up the floating rock that was his territory. From his high spot, 10 stories up, he could watch his army put through drills and training. They were camped out around the grounds, most in cabins more permanent than just simple tents. There were fires lit up about, and a crew were cleaning the dishes from an early lunch. Marius had 2,500 slaves, though only 2,000 of them were combat-ready. It was impressive for a lesser royal, but beyond modest in comparison with some of the higher royals of Dunkel. 2,000 men, women, creatures, and monsters. And not one of them was his friend. He had thousands who would hold on to every word he spoke, but no one he could actually talk to. Besides Mother Golem, of course, and she had no way to talk back. There was only one other person he knew who would talk back to him, and he made her the commander of his whole army. He could see her with her floppy, wide-brimmed hat that narrowed in the front and her 2 short swords hanging on either side of her belt. Even from all the way up there, he could hear her screaming at his soldiers to do exercise drills of push-ups and laps, or run an obstacle course that they'd built on his grounds, or spar with one another using dull practice weapons they kept in the armory for training. Marius sighed, looking up at the sky and allowing himself to soak in his own depression a little longer. Once he was satisfied that he had reached his daily quota for emo, he allowed himself to turn a smoke and wafted down from the balcony, flying free through the air as he slowly floated down the side of his keep. Above him, he could hear Mother Golem cry after him, but he was already gone.
Put your backs into it,
the goblin commander yelled at Marius's troops as they rushed through their drills. Marius formed himself from the smoke back into his corporeal form just behind Commander Patricia, his black boots softly settling onto the purplish-gray dirt of his fortress grounds.
"Aye,"
Batty yelled to a blacksmith, maybe 10 yards away.
"That guy over there is swinging his sword. That guy over there is swinging his sword way too heavily."
She pointed at the man she meant. He was a larger human, sweaty and clumsily swinging his sword around in a spar with another opponent.
"Get the man an axe or something for the sake of the gods."
"Batty,"
Marius said his commander's name, and she jumped almost twice her height.
"How many times I told you not to sneak up on me like that?"
Batty complained, turning around as she clutched her chest. Marius tried to hide the thin smile he could feel growing on his face. "Tell me about my black knights," he inquired of her.
"They'll march again,"
Batty promised the lesser royal. It was important to him that his army be organized, disciplined, uniform. It was all about the illusion, about striking fear into his enemies. The more he could intimidate the people he marched against, the more likely those people were to surrender with minimal casualties. Appearances were sometimes more important than actions. Batty glanced at the larger man she'd previously pointed out, the new recruit being handed an axe instead. The commander had been right. He did seem more comfortable with it in his hands, even though it didn't look like he'd ever fought a day in his life before Goldak threw him and all those others up against Marius's forces.
"Some are going to need a few weeks."
"We have till tomorrow,"
Marius informed her. The look she gave him wasn't her usual accepting one.
"We were given a new mission."
"Your army isn't ready,"
she insisted.
"They need time to rest, unwind."
They weren't going to get that chance.
"How many did we take?"
Marius asked, nodding at the new recruit, now winning his sparring match with brute strength alone. His partner was thrown to the floor and inched away in fear, even though the axe was just a training axe.
"Under 50 new recruits,"
Batty informed him. She always kept on top of such details.
"Some of which have never even held a weapon before,"
she added as she began to lead him through the grounds, past his soldiers towards his fortress.
"And what they say happened out there."
"Be happy I left you behind,"
Marius told her as she trailed off.
"And I intend to again."
Water break. Do-do-do-do-do. Really phlegmy this morning.
"Be happy that I left you behind, and I intend to again, along with the new recruits, so you can keep working on them."
"Oh, thanks,"
she muttered, but leaving her behind wasn't for her benefit. Leaving the castle empty would only encourage other royals, even ones who weren't currently poised against Marius, to push an attack in his absence. They entered into his fortress from the side, the library to their left. But they went right instead. Most royals would never allow their slaves within their castle, but Marius wasn't most people. And there was a room of his fortress perfectly suited for use as an infirmary. And it was there that Batty led him.
"We have 10 wounded,"
Batty continued telling him,
"7 of which were their people, and 1 was your elite squad sergeant."
The small goblin brought Marius to the side of a bed, where a tall, muscular woman with brown hair pulled back into a ponytail laid with her leg up and bandaged.
"I'm sorry, my lord."
let me try that voice again.
"I'm sorry, my lord,"
Elite Squad Sergeant Cara Develine apologized, showing him respect even though she was many years his senior.
"Can you believe a goblin did this to my leg? Can you believe a goblin did this to my leg?"
"Yes,"
Batty said sternly, crossing her arms in offense. Kara opened her mouth as if to apologize, but Batty spoke over her to Marius.
"She'll be out of commission for a couple weeks at least. So unless you're intending to march without your elite squad, I'd suggest blowing off this mission and giving your people the time they need."
"Patricia,"
Marius spoke to the commander's name.
"I can't blow this one off,"
he assured her,
"else we become the target."
He didn't think the goblin would like facing off against Draxia's forces, or serving as her slave. Patricia wouldn't like leading Draxia's army. The higher royal was ruled by chaos. It was a chaos that was scary in its own way. But Patricia was like Marius. She preferred a little order.
"But the elite Black Knights will stay behind with their leader,"
he decided, crossing his arms to match Batty.
"I'll be fine with the bulk of my army and my 3 golems."
The elite squad of the Black Knights was a squadron of his best fighters, his most esteemed. They had started at 12 in number, but had grown to 25 as more soldiers in his army showed aptitude on the battlefield.
"My lord,"
Kara spoke, the pain in her voice evident,
Our sole purpose is to protect your life.
Your purpose is to do as I say, Marius told her coldly. And I'm telling you, your squad, and I'm telling your squad to protect my stuff. My stuff is worth a hell of a lot more to me than my life, so you'll be doing me a great honor.
Kara leaned back in her bed, puffing out her chest proudly with a smile growing on her lips.
Then no one shall touch your stuff, as for as long as I still breathe.
She spoke, seemingly content with her assignment.
Good, he said with a nod. Once you are feeling well enough, you can brief the rest of your squad.
He turned to leave his loyal subject for recovery, but once he was outside the infirmary, Batty stopped him.
Marius, she said after him, and he froze. You can fool the rest of them, but I know you.
He raised an eyebrow at his commander.
And what is it that you know?
You're afraid,
Batty said, glaring at him from under her wide-brimmed hat.
I can see it all over you.
Marius imagined that any other royal would be seething with anger at any such accusation from one of their slaves.
It's just a simple village,
Marius tried to assure the goblin.
It holds no threat to me at all. I wouldn't give it a second thought if Draxia were not forcing my hand.
And that's what you're trying to protect us from,
Batty accused him.
Not danger, per se, but the deplorable things Draxia is making you do in her name.
She poked him in the leg.
You don't want me seeing that side of you.
Maybe you're right,
Marius mused at his commander, throwing his arms up in a shrug.
Maybe I'm trying to protect you from getting the same blood on your hands that I've gotten on mine.
Good,
Batty grunted and passed him for the door, surprising Marius with her blunt reaction. He'd expected her to fight to be at his side.
I don't need that kind of shit on my conscience.
She stepped in the front foyer as he watched after her and turned around.
What about my conscience?
He asked her, his jaw hanging open.
What about my soul?
Batty laughed.
What soul? You gave that up the minute you did all that to yourself.
She gestured at him.
Now you want what, pity? You put yourself in this place of power thinking you could make a difference, thinking there wouldn't be a price. But you didn't know what you'd have to do to hold on to it, what you'd lose. And now, after so many people are dead, you're having second thoughts. You're right,
she said with a shake of her head.
I don't want any piece of that. I'm glad you're not taking me with you, but don't think for a second you're disillusioning me to what's happening out there.
Water break, do-do-do-do-do.
Because I know everything,
she growled accusatorily.
Oldak was your friend.
Marius shook his head.
I don't have any friends.
No,
Batty said with a shake of her head.
You don't. They're all dead now. So yeah, you go ahead and leave me behind on this mission. But don't lie to me about why.
Batty,
Marius called after her, but she was already back outside yelling orders. And Marius was in his fortress, all alone, as usual. Scene change. Bop, bop, bada, bada. Scene change, bump, bop, bada, bada. Scene change, bop, bop, bada, 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 bop, bada, bop, bada, bada.
Finally, you made it,
Lexi said to Gorky as he stepped into the town hall. It was a large wooden building, the largest in the village that wasn't for storing food, and it was packed with people as everyone showed up for the called meeting.
Come on, Lexi said, grabbing Gorky's hand. We're playing Red Rover, and I want you to be on my team.
Gorky, being pulled along by Lexi, grabbed Ronan's hand with his free one.
I'll only play if Ronan can play too.
Gorky blurted out at his 7-year-old girlfriend. Lexi looked Ronan up and down disapprovingly.
Ugh, you brought him? Hi,
Ronan said with a shy wave. Whenever Ronan had entered town, he'd always stayed close to his family and never tried to interact with the other kids. He'd always imagined that it wouldn't end well.
Don't talk to me,
Lexi said to Ronan coldly. Things going about as Ronan had expected, and the bully turned back to Gorky.
Fine, but he's not holding my hand.
They surged through the crowds of people, Gorky dragging him along after Lexi, and Ronan gave one final wave back to his dad as Derman went out of view. Scene change.
Bop!
Derman watched Ronan run off with his new friends and felt a tinge of pride for his son. Finally, the kid was starting to fit in.
Derman! The mayor called across the room, pushing through the crowds of people to grab Derman's arm. At last, we can begin.
Derman gave Tina a meek smile.
You could have started without me,
he assured her, but she quickly shook off his humility with a shake of her head.
Don't be ridiculous,
Mayor Knowles said, pulling Derman through the crowds in much the same way his son had just been yanked away.
You're my partner in this.
They got to the front of the room, and she turned to check him out, quickly.
You look nice, by the way,
she told him breathlessly. He had picked out his good shirt for their meeting, one Goldak had given him. A silk black one with a fancy but also subtle color. He'd picked out the subtlest one Goldak had had, but the man didn't exactly trade in subtle.
I feel like that should be there, and then that, nope, should be there. Oops, now I gotta fix this. Boop, boop, da boop, and then a boop, da boop. Okay, cool. Anyway, reads the same.
Not that you didn't look nice before,
Tina quickly corrected herself.
I'm just happy to be wearing clothes this time,
Derman muttered, giving the mayor his best fake smile. Tina laughed.
That's a good one,
she said, punching his arm. He hadn't been joking. Tina had also changed, out of the soaked frilly dress she'd been wearing that morning and into a more simple outfit with a skirt and leather suspenders. Christina Knowles adjusted those suspenders as she stepped up onto the stage in front of all the people in that hall. There was close to 200 people gathered there, more than they could fit if everyone were to sit down.
People,
the mayor called out to everyone.
Everyone!
People were still ignoring her and talking amongst each other.
Westerly,
she yelled out, and a number of people finally quieted down.
Could I have your attention, please?
The final few people talking turned to see what she...
Why does that look like it's not loud enough? Is that better?
Okay, sorry.
People, everyone, Westerly.
That might be too loud. Sorry.
People, everyone, Westerly.
Whatever, I'm going to keep going.
Could I have your attention, please?
The final few people talking turned to see what everyone else was looking at, and the mayor finally had quiet.
A good 2/3 of our village must be here,
Tina told everyone gathered,
and I'm sure those who aren't had a very good reason. That's good. I applaud the pride we all have for Westerly. We all had to do our part in growing this village into the thriving town it is. We are all Westerly. And I want to promise you, before I begin, that the village is not under any immediate threat,
she assured everyone in attendance. One concerned woman closest to the stage visibly relaxed and took a breath.
So no one panic over what I'm going to say next. But Derman has reported to me nearby royal activity.
There was murmuring throughout the large hall, and people started talking amongst themselves again.
Please, people, Tina insisted of the room, if you could address your questions towards me, thank you.
She quickly muttered under her breath,
and not each other.
She stretched her hands out in a shrug as if it was obvious. Royals haven't stepped one...
Royals haven't stepped one foot in this valley for as many decades as this valley has existed.
One man with an uncomfortable-looking hat yelled out at Mayor Knowles.
That's true, Tina said, pointing at the man. But the founder of this village had the north and south walls built because Mr. Westall predicted the day might come when we would have to defend it against the outside world.
The south wall stood between the village and Lynn and Durman's land. The north wall covered the path Lynn would have had to have taken out of the valley. Both gates had been kept open for as long as Durman had lived there. He'd never feared them closing the gates to him or his family, and even if they tried, he imagined Lynn could just scale the wall effortlessly. It was barely over 2 stories tall, after all.
I want to form a part-time militia,
Tina told the crowd, and again the group erupted in excited discussion.
You can't be serious,
a man in the crowd yelled.
How are you going to force to do that rubbish?
A large woman yelled from the front of the crowd, a baby hanging from her breast.
I ain't going. Who's to look after my 6 children, I?
She's like the woman from the spam sketch in Monty Python.
Oi, what can I get you? We got spam, 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 eggs and spam, bacon and spam, 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 sausage and spam. What can I get something without spam? We have eggs, bacon, spam, and sausage. That's only got a little spam.
Anyway. Where were we? That was not part of the story. Back to the story.
We aren't forcing anyone at this current time,
Tina assured the rowdy group of villagers.
It's going to be volunteer only, but we're hoping 100 people will come out.
More murmuring.
There are only 300 people in Westerly.
A particularly catty woman yelled from the back of the room where she was surrounded by all her girlfriends.
And you want us to give 100 of our men to your militia? Not just men,
Mayor Tina Knowles corrected the woman.
Women can join as well, as long as they do not have a child between the ages of 0 and 6. That includes no pregnant women.
There was more murmuring throughout the room.
What makes you think anyone will show?
Oh, this is a handsome man.
What makes you think anyone will show? I'm a handsome man,
says a handsome man with bronze skin and dark hair.
You couldn't pay me,
the woman with 6 kids said, though with the baby in her arms, it was clear she was disqualified anyway.
I wouldn't go no matter what. I'm going to just stay here and cook my spam. Spam, spam, spam.
It will not be a paid position,
Tina Knowles told the room. More laughter.
But it also won't be a lot of your time. Just a couple of hours of training a day, and once people are comfortable with weapons in their hands, we'll start assigning people 4 hours of guard duty a week.
The murmuring only intensified, and people began to leave out the door.
I was hoping, she called after them, that protecting our village would be incentive enough for people to show. Please spread word of the militia to those that aren't here. It's really quite important.
Half the hall had already cleared out as she gestured off the side of the stage.
Durman will be in charge of the militia. You can talk to him for more details.
At this point, no one was paying attention, except for one attentive woman in the front who gave a nod.
I'll be there, Mayor.
The blonde woman spoke enthusiastically with wide dreamer-like eyes.
Thank you, Anya,
Tina said dismissively, turning to Durman as she climbed down from her stage.
I think that went well,
she told him as he gave her a hand to help her down.
At least Anya will be there,
Durman said with a bit of a smile on his face. If no one showed, Maybe he would be saved from having to actually take part. "Don't get too excited," Tina muttered. "She's a little..." The mayor made a motion with her finger to the side of her head and whistled.
"That's not very nice," Dermot said, though in his time knowing the mayor, nice was never a word he'd used to describe her.
"What's not very nice is every guy in the village refusing to date her," Tina argued with him, "because she talks too much, or she's too passionate, or too enthusiastic, not normal."
"Sounds like someone I know," Dermot said, watching the mayor fume with a chuckle.
"Sounds like someone I know, too," Noel said, and Dermot supposed she meant his wife.
Where he saw equivalence between the mayor and Anya's personalities, he could tell Tina saw more equivalence between Anya and Lynn, and their status as outsiders.
"Perhaps if she finds a purpose in the militia," Tina said as they got to the door of the hall, "we can both protect the city from the royals and get her mother off my back. Two birds, one stone."
With that, she was out the door into the sunlight of the day.
"But one of those birds is a little bigger than the other," Dermot yelled after her. "Wouldn't you say?"
There was no response. Scene change. Bop, bop, ba-da-ba-dop. Scene change. Bop, bop, ba-da-ba-dop. Scene change. Bop, bop, ba-da-ba-dop, ba-da-ba-dop. Bop, ba-da-bop, bop, ba-da-ba-dop. And it's basically going to be with Lynn and Allie for the rest of the book. So, and for the rest of the chapter. So, enjoy that. Here we go. Now I need voices for them.
"You must love that horse more than your own mother,"
Lynn commented, watching Allie feed Bill an apple. It was the first time she had seen her daughter not with her nose planted in a book since they'd set out.
"Jealous?"
Jealous? Allie asked with a sly look at Lynn.
"I could feed you an apple too if you want." "Thanks. Thanks for the offer,"
Lynn said, giving her daughter a sneer as she turned the snake over the fire. She'd seen it from the road, slithering on its way. Since they had been just about to stop for dinner, she had taken the snake as a sign they should do just that. The dead forests around them had gotten thicker, though from what Lynn remembered, that meant they were almost out the other side, and then would be the fields of yellowing grass and tall weed grass. Lynn didn't need Allie's books to tell her all that. She remembered a lot from her time traveling those roads. Maybe she didn't have an encyclopedic knowledge of which road led to which town, but back then it never really mattered. She'd never really have a destination, so much as just accepted where the journey would take her. How times changed. Things had become so much more complicated when she had to settle down and become a mother. In comparison, being a roving adventurer had been easy. A breeze. Speaking of breezes, there had been no more whispers on the wind since they had taken the left path many forks ago, which was all just fine for Lynn. Now if she could only shake the feeling like they were being watched. She knew they weren't. She had done a circle of the perimeter while she was collecting up wood for the fire. She could be certain there was no one for half a kilometer in any direction. But still she couldn't shake that cold shiver on her spine. Something wasn't right.
"It's ready,"
Lynn said, taking the snake off the fire. Allie turned pale as she looked at it.
"Don't worry," Lynn assured her. "I gutted it first." "I know that."
Oh, no, sorry, that's not what she said.
"You know what?"
Allie said.
"I'm not that hungry anymore."
Makes more sense. All right.
"Your loss,"
Lynn said, pulling a dagger from her bandolier under her jacket and slicing open the snake's skin. Peeling it back, she ripped away a chunk, the meat having the consistency of chicken and the taste of fish.
"It's good. It's good."
Sorry.
"Me and Bill are just fine with our apples," Allie told her mother. "Aren't we, Bill? Aren't we?"
Allie's horse whinnied, and she patted it lovingly. Lynn ripped another mouthful of meat from her snake and chewed vigorously while savoring the juices. She hadn't been lying. Snake grossed out a lot of people, but in her experience it made for good eating.
"So I've been poring over my books," Allie said, pulling a specific one from her bag and leafing through it. "I noticed,"
Lynn said, swallowing her mouthful of snake.
"I believe if we ride all night, we can make it to the forest by mid-morning.
she explained, showing Lynn an open page on her book.
"What am I looking at here?"
Lynn asked as Ali sat down next to her. It was a map, and Ali dragged her finger along the road.
"That's how much we've done so far," she said, pointing at a forest on the other edge of the page, "and that's our destination."
"So we're over halfway there?" Lynn tried to follow along, her mouth full of snake again. Sorry, I'm so phlegmy. Sorry.
"Yeah."
Sorry, that was just sounded like a goblin.
"Yeah,"
Lynn agreed with her mom.
"And if we continue this pace..."
Lynn chuckled at her daughter.
"It's kind of hard to continue a steady pace in the middle of the night," she informed Ali as she swallowed her mouthful. "It's an easy way to walk headlong into a tree."
She put down her snake on the dead log beside her.
"People think they can pull an all-nighter, but they always forget what comes after the night."
"What's that?" Ali asked as Lynn poured some water on her hands to wipe them clean, and I drank some water because I'm thirsty. Water break. All right. Wiped her hands clean.
"Another day," Lynn said.
Let me do this whole thing again because I interrupted the punchline.
"People think they can pull an all-nighter, but they always forget what comes after the night."
"What's that?"
"Another day," Lynn said as if it was some big reveal.
Ali pouted and crossed her arms.
"I think I can handle it,"
she promised her mom,
"unless you don't think you can handle it."
Lynn laughed.
"I was more worried about you," she said, shoving her daughter playfully. "I've done my share of night riding."
"Then you're okay with it, then? Then you're okay with it, then?" Ali suggested, as Lynn picked up her snake and took as many quick, meaningful bites as she could. Did I use "then" too many times that sentence? Sure. Could that have been deliberate because it's dialogue? Sure. So we're just going to keep it.
"Then you're okay with it, then?"
I mean, it sounds pretty good. I mean, said out loud, even if it looks awful.
"Sure," she said with a stuffed mouth. "The alternatives see us getting to the forest by nightfall tomorrow, and good luck finding your blue flower then."
She began kicking dirt on the fire at her feet.
"Let's do this,"
Lynn said with a glance up at the sky.
"Make some good progress while we still have light."
She couldn't see the sun, but with the dull gray of the sky, she knew it would set soon. Once she was sure the fire was out, she didn't want to be the one that got blamed for burning down half the dead woods. They packed up their things and strapped everything once more to their horses.
"You sure Bill and Bet will be okay?"
Lynn asked, giving her old lady a firm pat.
"Oh, yeah,"
Lynn said, scratching Bill's chin.
"You'll be fine, won't you, Bill?"
Bill let out a snort, and Ali hugged him affectionately, scratching lovingly at his side. I forgot to do the whinny. There, so that was the whinny from earlier, and this is the snort again. See, I'm pretty good at horse noises. I could have been a horse in another life. You never know. Well, you gotta be able to do. All right. They got on their horses and continued on down the road. Not at a full gallop, but at a pace faster than a trot. See, I could have been a horse in another life. They held that pace for at least 30 minutes, maybe 40. By that point, the sun's light was almost gone completely, and the darkness of the dead woods made it easier for Lynn to spot the flames of the torches up ahead. Marilyn leaned over and smacked Ali's arm, jostling her from her heavy slumber. Her head rested against Bill's mane.
"Wake up,"
Lynn insisted sharply over her daughter.
"What's going on?"
Ali asked groggily, looking around confused.
I wasn't sleeping, I swear."
"Uh-huh," Lynn muttered.
"Up ahead. We're coming up on something."
As they got closer, they could see that it was a couple of men with some bad luck. Their cart stuck in the gutter on the side of the road. The men looked poor and unbathed, wearing mismatched leathers and missing teeth.
"We're going to stop to help them. Are we going to stop to help them?"
Ali whispered to her mother. Lynn shook her head.
"It's a trap," she promised her daughter. "Just keep riding and don't catch their eye."
They surged forward on their horses, trying not to look like they were rushing, but keeping a steady pace as they passed the cart. The two torches the men had illuminated the dark, dead forest with creepy. The two torches the men had... Okay, here we go. The two torches the men had illuminated the dark dead forest with creepy shadows, as the naked trees were about as thick around there as they could get.
Tarnations!
One man said, throwing his leather cap on the ground and stepping on it.
We'll never get this shipment of food, of supplies to those starving children. Tarnations!
Mom, Allie said to her mom, what would a hero do? They would help these people, right?
Yeah, Mom,
the man who had just stepped on his hat said, as the girls were just passing him by.
What would a hero do? We just need help getting this wagon out. And tarnations.
Sorry, I just like that word.
Come on, Allie insisted. It doesn't smell like a trap to me.
Lynn shook her head, immediately knowing this is going to turn ugly. Her hand groped at her spear with anticipation.
They have enough help, she assured Allison. There's four more of them hiding in the forest around us.
She could hear them breathe and sense their slight movements in the dark.
So, you smelled a trap.
A tall, pale man with fair skin and a rich accent said as he stepped out of the dead woods holding a crossbow.
And yet, you stepped into it anyway. So, you smelled our trap, and yet you stepped into it anyway.
How about this?
Lynn offered the men around her as they all stepped out of the woods with their crossbows drawn.
Let me and my daughter go, and I won't make this hard on you. You can fuck with the next folks that come through here, and I won't stop you.
The man laughed, looking at the men around him.
She won't stop us,
he said, laughing, and everyone around him laughed too.
Did you hear that?
We have nothing you want,
Lynn assured him.
Oh, we'll be the judge of that,
the rich-accented man with pale skin said, his black hair shaved short and seemed like spikes in the firelight.
Come on, someone else in the group said. They're just a woman and her kid. Let them go.
They're really pretty, though,
a third person spoke up.
Don't be gross, Aelon,
the second person said to the third. The man who had spoken up first raised his crossbow at Marilyn, and she pulled free her spear.
Don't do it,
she begged him, but he fired at her, and she lifted her spear to block it. Only he wasn't aiming at her. He was aiming at her horse's leg. Bet dropped, whinnying in agony as it fell on top of Lynn and pinned her in place.
No! No!
Lynn could hear Allie shriek as the other three raised their crossbows.
No, don't!
They fired.
No!
Lynn could hear her daughter scream as she watched the crossbows go off and heard her daughter fall with her horse.
You son of a bitch! Lynn swore at the man in charge. Anyone who touches her is fucking dead!
Well then,
the man with the accent said.
Well then, as a good leader, I suppose I should take full responsibility for that myself.
He stepped away from Lynn and out of her view.
Aelon, go through her stuff while I tie her hands.
Let go of me!
Lynn could hear Allie scream. One of the others in the group grabbed Lynn's hands, tying them together and kicking her spear away as she glanced at it.
I'm sorry,
the man said, unpinning her from the wounded and struggling horse once he was sure her hands were tightly bound.
I didn't want any of this,
he assured her as he took her sword away. It was the same guy who had earlier pleaded to let them go.
It doesn't really matter what you wanted,
Lynn muttered to him. Does it?
Hey, boss,
Aelon said from the ground where he was going through Allie's bags.
The lady wasn't lying. These are old books.
The man in charge looked surprised.
They're really valuable books, Lynn told the men. They make
They may look worthless to you, but some of them are very rare.
Elon looked confused at the whole concept of a valuable book.
Take them, the leader said to Elon, just in case. Just in case.
I'm doing a really poor job of his accent, I'm sorry. It's going back and forth between all these voices. It's really difficult.
He grabbed Ali's arm, her hands tied behind her back like Lin's, and pushed her forward and away from the crying horses.
Ali turned around to address them.
I'll let you do whatever you want to me if you save the horses, she begged him.
First off, the man in the accent said, I don't give a flying fuck what you give me permission to do. You're not in charge here. I am.
He pulled out Ali's short sword from her pack, admiring it as he crouched down beside Bill, the horse snorting and crying and whinnying with three crossbow bolts already in its side.
Now, the leader said, the second thing, you can't save a wounded horse. The leg will never grow back right. It will never be able to run the same ever again.
Get away from him!
Ali shrieked hysterically as the man reached out to touch her horse.
Don't touch him!
There's only one thing a wounded horse is good for, the leader said, bringing Ali's sword to the horse's throat and slicing along the neck.
The horse whinnied and screamed in agony as the blood poured out from the neck and all over the floor as the bandit at the bandit leader's feet.
Abstract art, the leader said, staring at the blood splatter as it spread out across the dirt road. I'm seeing a chicken. Wait, no, a cart. Hey, maybe it's a story of us.
You motherfucker!
Ali screamed at the leader as the fourth bandit grabbed her by the torso and began carrying her away. She thrashed and struggled at him, but in vain.
Fuck you, piece of fucking shit! I see a lake,
Elon said to the leader, staring down at the blood splatter and ignoring Ali's scream.
A lake of blood.
He seemed proud at his imagination. His boss, however, was less impressed.
Kill the other one and meet us back at camp, the boss ordered Elon.
So there was a camp, with more of them. The boss approached the bandit that had tied Lin's hands, and he took her sword.
Nice sword, the leader said as he unsheathed it to look at it in the moonlight. Better than your daughter's, he said, sheathing it again. What was hers? A hand-me-down?
He clipped Lin's sword to his belt.
I suppose I'll just take your sword and your daughter's virginity.
Up ahead, he could hear her daughter sobbing uncontrollably. Up ahead, she could hear her daughter sobbing uncontrollably. Okay. The leader left Lin to catch up, and Lin was pushed forward by the man who had tied her hands. While apologizing for everything, the man had made one vital mistake. He'd forgotten to pat her down for any other weapons. She let the bandits lead her back to their camp, and then she'd make the man regret his mistake. She'd make the entire camp regret ever fucking with her or her daughter, or their horses. And that was the end of week 3. And we're going to move on to week 4. I totally wanted to end that with a positive, like, oh, she's going to kill them all, because I didn't want to end week 3 with, they're about to get raped, and then leave people there like, oh my god, they're going to get raped, they're going to get raped, they're going to get raped for like a week. That seemed like a terrible thing to do. So I made sure to put that, interesting. Alright, sorry. I made sure to put that, that positive spin at the end, that she was going to fight back. Anyway, moving on to week number 4.
Keep moving, the one who had previously shown sympathy to her said, shoving her lightly ahead of him.
They had left the road shortly after the sun had set, and it was impossible for Marilyn to see where she was going. She tripped over a root, stumbling forward and leaning against a tree.
Mom!
Lynn's daughter called out in the dark, then could feel Allison lean against her.
What did Terry just say?
The leader of the group asked, his footsteps crunching on the twigs of dead wood scattered across the forest floor as he approached them. Lynn assumed Terry was the one who had just shoved her.
She tripped, Terry tried to explain.
Lynn glowered at the gang leader's black shape in the darkness.
It's hard to see where we're going, she complained. Do you even know?
Allie asked from beside her, struggling with her restraints. Lynn could feel the bandit leader reaching out and pulled her daughter away from her.
Hey!
Lynn yelled out.
Know where my base is?
The leader asked Allie with amusement in his voice, ignoring Lynn completely.
You'd like that we were lost, wouldn't you?
His accented voice moved away from Lynn and he pushed forward, and she pushed forward after it.
Well, sorry to disappoint you, my dear, but it's just up over here.
Lynn followed the footsteps for less than 2 minutes before she could see a faint light ahead of them through the trees. It was like an orange glow that didn't so much illuminate the forest as contrast against it, making the trees around her blacker than black against its growing radiance. Right. Let's try that sentence again. It was like an orange glow that didn't much illuminate the forest so much as contrast against it, making the trees around her blacker than black against its growing radiance. And then, without any warning, she was through the trees and standing on the edge of a small round camp. Small in comparison to a village, though still quite large to fit a dozen tents and multiple fire pits filled with burning logs from the dead trees of the surrounding woods. It seemed that these bandits had been set up there for a while, clearing trees to grow their camp and using the wood for fire. And there were more than Lynn had expected. There were 3 large fires, but with 4 smaller ones in areas of the camp the 3 large ones didn't reach. The tents were all arranged around the fires, at a safe distance, of course, but it didn't seem like everyone got a tent, with a lot of men huddled closer to the fire for warmth, all their belongings in a pile around them. There were 3 at that fire, 3 more at that one, 2 there, just 1 at that fire. She could see maybe only 4 of the tents were currently occupied, with the flaps open to allow the heat from the fire in. Since the night had fallen, it had begun getting quite chilly. Around the large fire pit, she counted 7 people, some drinking, though at least one. Let me try this whole paragraph again. There were 3 at that fire, 3 more at that one, 2 there, just 1 at that fire. She could see maybe only 4 of the tents were occupied, with the flaps open to allow the heat from the fire in. Since the night had fallen, it had gotten quite chilly. Around the large fire pit, she counted 7 people, some drinking, though at least one was hard at work hammering at an anvil. Lynn supposed every bandit camp needed its own blacksmith. What she couldn't see was even one woman. She wondered why. There was movement on the outside of the camp around her, and she realized there were 4 more men in the camp with large axes cutting wood, plus the 6 bandits with her. That made 30. An impressive size for a bandit group.
Impressed? The leader asked Lynn as he watched her for the couple of seconds it took her to take all that in. Mom?
Allie said from beside him, looking at Lynn with concerned eyes.
Mom?
Allie said from beside him, looking at Lynn with concerned eyes. Clearly she had still been expecting Lynn to come up with some miraculous save. The leader looked from the daughter to her mother.
Oh no, the boss said. We're going to split the 2 of you up.
He yelled out to the camp.
We've returned with spoils.
He yelled at the camp of people as he dragged Allie after him towards one of the larger tents. He yelled at his crew of people. So we don't say camp twice in that paragraph. He yelled at his crew of people as he dragged Allie after him towards one of the larger tents. Towards the largest tent, I'm sorry.
We have food! We have food!
He yelled as the bandits following behind them came out of the woods and threw down all the women's supplies onto the floor of the camp. About 6 men, all dressed in sweaty, sticky leathers, as most of them were, began rummaging through the supplies, pulling out all the food and water and passing it around.
What about that bag?
Asked a bandit, peeking out from a tent and pointing to a sack Elon, the dumbass of their initial group, was plunking down separate from the other bags. From the looks of the people in that camp, Elon had some steep competition for the title of dumbass.
Books!
Elon called out to the man, and they both made the exact same disgusted face.
Do leave that sack alone,
the leader called out from the door of the largest tent. We'll send a runner to pawn them off in Nokafe tomorrow. He pushed Ali into the tent before him. Now, he yelled out to everyone, I'm claiming this girl for myself. His gaze fell on Lin. You can do whatever you want with her. He nodded in her direction. Though if I were a betting man, I'd say she's a biter. He smiled. Good luck.
Good luck. I always thought I would say that like the way Dumbledore says good luck in Prisoner of Azkaban. Good luck. Good luck. Yeah, no, it's more like that. Good luck. Yeah, like he has no idea what's going on. And then they bump into him and they're like, Professor, we did it. We did it. We went back in time and did all this timey-wimey stuff. And the professor's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I was just here. I just closed the door to you and now you're here. That's so weird. And then he like touches his nose and walks away. And there was that whole thing with like him, with like the hippogriffs, and he's told, and like you're totally like, does he know that Harry, Hermione, and Ron are there? Like, can he somehow see through A, the invisibility cloak, and B, time? Like, what the fuck? it's fucked. That scene was awesome. That's one of my favorite parts in Harry Potter. But anyway, J.K. Rowling is a transphobe, and we're moving on. He's like, Grunlock. And then he disappeared into his tent after her daughter. She watched him go, stared at the tent with fire in her eyes, even as four of the bandits ignored the supplies to begin circling her.
Who gets her first?
Who gets her first?
One of the men said, a particularly fat one with a pig nose. I don't know why I gave him a... Let me change his voice.
Who gets her first?
One of the men said, a particularly fat one with a pig nose.
Maybe the whole camp gang bangs her in front of a fire.
A scrawny bandit beside him crooned sickeningly.
I think Terry should get it first go,
Elon suggested, joining the circle of them.
He was old lover boy on her earlier.
I was not.
Terry started to argue with a shake of his head, but he was immediately drowned out by the people around him.
Yeah, Terry. You ain't never want to take part,
one bandit yelled. The fat bandit slapped Terry on the back.
You can even use my tent.
Everyone had apparently decided, and then was shoved into Terry, who grabbed her arm. Her hands were still bound, and she could do nothing as the two of them were shepherded by the other bandits into one of the smaller tents. Scene change. Bop, bop, ba-da-ba-da-bop. Bop. Scene change. Bop, bop, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-bop. Just two of those scene changes. Allison was thrown in the corner of the leader's large cozy tent. It was large enough to contain a bed and other furniture, a dresser, a desk in the corner, even a mirror. Allie settled into a rug of furs on the floor, her hands bound in front of her as she stared up at the large imposing bandit leader. The leader turned away from her, stripping his bulky padded armor away and putting it up on a mannequin.
Tell me, he spoke at last, Allie afraid to break the silence, about the books in your bag.
What? Allie asked, trembling. All she could think about was the horrible screams of agony Bill had been giving off before they killed him. She hadn't thought horses could even make noises like that. All that blood.
The bag was yours, wasn't it?
The bandit leader asked Allie, bringing her back to reality. She nodded numbly.
So what's inside it? He asked her. Tell me about these books.
Well... Ali said, stuttering as her mind scrambled to remember even one of the books she had in her bag.
There's a story about a bat that gets turned into a gargoyle.
I don't care what they're about,
the leader said, turning around, wearing nothing but a tight pair of... That's the wrong pair. Wearing a tight pair as in the fruit pair? Wow. I didn't know you could wear a pair. That's what was clothing.
I don't care what they're about, the leader said, turning around, wearing nothing but a tight pair of leather pants. Tell me about how much they're worth. You see, money gets me hard. So if you tell me how much money I'm going to make tomorrow, we can get this party started.
Allie scrunched up her face in confusion, her trauma momentarily forgotten.
Money?
She asked in surprise. He nodded, reaching his hand into his pants, in anticipation.
This isn't funny, I'm sorry.
But it's kind of bullshit, though, right?
The bandit leader stopped moving.
I mean,
Ellie continued,
it doesn't have any actual real value, right? It's a man-made invention, and society gives it a perceived value that is, in reality, completely imaginary.
The leader seemed confused how to feel about her words.
What?
He asked at last.
Seriously,
she said, figuring that as long as she could keep talking, she could keep some semblance of control.
I read about it in a book. Have you heard about Scrip?
He shook his head.
Well, there's this book I have on numismatics.
Scene change. Scene change. Ba 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 da da ba 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 da ba ba da da da.
I'm sorry,
Terry muttered again as he shoved Lynn into the tent. She didn't fall down onto the sleeping bag, instead staying on her feet, straight and proud. The tent was so small that her head touched the roof. Terry came in after her.
I have to do this,
he told her, a look of anguish on his face.
No, you don't,
Lynn told him, ready to give him another option.
No one can even see us now.
Oh, no,
Terry muttered, and his mind seemed decided.
They always know.
But there's another way. There's another way, she suggested. You can cut my bonds and free me, and let me free. If we cut a hole in the back of the tent, you can escape from here into the woods.
Terry looked confused at her suggestion.
You mean you can escape into the woods?
He paused for a moment.
Right?
She shook her head.
No.
Terry still seemed confused, but instead of engaging her further, he instead shook the notion from his head and pointed at the ground.
Just get on your knees and let's get this over with.
Lynn let out a breath. She had given him his chance, and she happily did as she was told. She knelt down on one knee, her bound hands slipping to her right boot. Terry began unbuttoning his pants as Lynn's fingers felt the familiar handle of her hidden knife. Lynn wrapped her fingers around the handle and pulled the knife loose, keeping it hidden behind her leg as she sliced it through her bindings in one strong slash.
What?
Terry started to say as he realized what she was doing, balling her right hand into a fist around the handle of the blade so that it poked out between two of her fingers. She punched up with her right hand like an uppercut to Terry's chin. The blade went through the bottom of his jaw, up into his skull, and his exclamation was cut short with an ooh. Lynn expected Terry to go down, but instead he moaned, and his arms began to flail around in agony. The blade hadn't been long enough to reach his brain. She pulled the blade out with a shook and embedded it into the side of his skull, his eyes finally glazing over as he dropped to the ground. Lynn pulled her knife free as he fell, but his arm knocked a canteen on the edge of the tent that rolled out the flap into the camp.
Hey!
Someone outside the tent yelled, the scrawny, perverted bandit from earlier peering into the flap with the canteen in his hand. Lynn threw her small knife across the tent to embed in the scrawny bandit's neck. She had really hoped he would fall into the tent and die. But instead, he stumbled back out of the tent, gurgling and spluttering as he collapsed onto the ground in front of the tent. Stumbled back out through the, you know, the same thing. I don't want to use the word tent that many times. God, my tummy is giving me the rumblies. So let me give me just a quick second. It'll be like 10 seconds.
And I'm back, and I totally could have just paused recording, but I'm sorry. I didn't do that. I was just got myself some yogurt, quickly downed it, and then I checked my air conditioner because it's always leaking when it gets humid, and it's really humid right now. And sure enough, it was leaking, but I have mops around it, so I just quickly, mopped it up, wrung out the mops, kind of keeping the water from spreading to cause damage or anything. Then I turned off the air conditioner so it can get rid of some of the water it's got inside, and then later it can dehumidify more. Anyway, where were we? Yes, that's right, she's killing people. Lynn threw her small knife across the tent to embed in the scrawny bandit's neck. She had really hoped he would fall into the tent and die, but instead he stumbled back out through the... I thought I just changed that. I could have sworn I just changed that. Alright, try that one more time. Lynn threw her small knife across the tent to embed in the scrawny bandit's neck. She had really hoped he would fall into the tent and die, but instead he stumbled back out through the flap, gurgling and spluttering as he collapsed onto the ground in front of the tent. See, one less tent makes that a little more palatable.
Royal Hells!
Someone else...
Royal Hells!
Someone else outside the tent exclaimed, apparently two of them having been standing guard, and then pulled free the two daggers from the bandolier under her jacket. It really was a good thing Terry had been too apologetic to properly search her. He'd also missed the hidden throwing axes on her right side. Steeling herself, she surged out of the tent in the direction of the person who had exclaimed, stabbing one of her daggers into the gut of the overweight bandit from earlier. It figured he'd been waiting with the scrawny one. The two of them had seemed friends. The man, in obvious pain, tried to bring his arm down on her like a club, but she blocked it with her left forearm. Though her arms were much smaller, she could easily match this man for strength, even without her right dagger in his belly. She pulled it out, stabbing him repeatedly as he made loud, angry noises that were mostly drowned out by the fire. Finally, she stabbed both daggers into either side of his head, and he dropped heavily. Her struggle with him alerted the last person around that small fire, a man who had had his back turned on the other side of the fire, sharpening his sword. He came at her with that sword, and she brought up both her knives for defense. I'm going to change that last sentence. Let's try that one. Her struggle with him alerted the last person around that small fire, a man who had had his back turned to the rest of them, sharpening his sword. There, that's better. He came at her with that sword, and she brought up both her knives for defense, using her right one to glance his first stroke aside. He was fast, swinging his sword around and in for another strike. She managed to glance that one aside too, twisting her body as it still narrowly missed her. And the man transitioned from that into a thrust, stabbing at her and glancing off her left hand as she twisted aside to avoid him. She dropped her dagger and shook her hand, blood pouring from the cut, but he'd thankfully missed her fingers. She backed away from him towards the fire as a man turned around, and instead of going for her dagger, she grabbed a burning log from the fire pit to wield in her left. She swung the large burning stick around to distract him, but he ignored it and sliced in at her. She deflected the sword away with her dagger, his blow so heavy that he knocked her second dagger free of her hand. He then brought his arm up to defend against what he must have thought her next move would be. Only she didn't swing in with a burning log, instead kicking out with her left leg and striking him in the stomach. He hadn't seen her kick coming, and fell back into the fire. Screaming, he quickly rolled out of the fire pit, but not before scalding himself terribly. As he rolled around in pain, she stabbed her burning log into his face, and he screamed in agony.
What the hell?
Came a voice from a tent she thought was empty. A man started to poke out of the tent, and before he could say anything more, Lynn had one of her throwing axes in her hand and throwing it across the camp to embed in the side of the man's face. He dropped to the ground, and a woman's voice behind him screamed out,
What in royal hells?
So there had been a woman in that camp after all. Get out of here, Lynn offered the woman, the same offer she wouldn't give to anyone else there. Now.
Not a chance in royal hell, bitch!
The woman spat out angrily as she came out of the tent wielding a sword.
You killed my boyfriend!
She charged at Lin, who immediately had the other throwing axe in her hand, and she knocked the woman's blade aside, dodging her completely. That is what that's supposed to say. Dodging her completely as the woman continued to stumble forward with her momentum. As the bandit woman centered herself, Lin reached down to pull her other axe from the woman's boyfriend. It made a gross shook as it came free, and the bandit woman took that as a personal insult, coming at her again. Let me try this whole paragraph over. Fuck it. As the bandit woman centered herself, Lin reached down to pull her other axe from the woman's friend. It made a gross shook as it came free, and the bandit woman took that as a personal insult. Coming at her again, the bandit woman slashed down hard, and this time not only did Lin deflect the sword with one axe, she used the other to slice a gash in the woman's hand. Similar to the one she'd sustained fighting the swordsman.
Damn it!
The woman yelled, grabbing at her hand with her other hand. Grabbing at her wound with her other hand. Let's try that again. Damn it! The woman yelled, grabbing at her wound with her other hand, but refusing to let go of her sword. Lin just watched the woman stumble about.
Come at me again and lose that hand.
Lin promised the woman, but she didn't listen. The woman charged her again, stabbing out with her sword and making it only too easy to dodge aside. Lin swung down with one axe, setting the sword down to stab into the dirt. Her other axe swung down and took the woman's hand as promised, and took off the woman's hand as promised. Her other axe swung down and took off the woman's hand as promised. The woman began screaming bloody murder, and then immediately brought her right axe up to embed into the woman's throat, cutting off her screams before they could carry too far. She was about to take in the camp and see who had heard anything, when she was suddenly tackled to the ground beside the fire. It was the swordsman she'd burned, apparently still with some fight in him. He lifted his sword over his head, his face bleeding and oozing. His flesh melted into something unrecognizable, and he brought his sword down from above, as if trying to cut her skull clear in half down the center. She grabbed at his arms, holding them in place and struggling against him as he put all his weight on his blade. With all her strength, she managed to force the sword back. With all her strength, she managed to force the sword back and punch him in the face with the hilt of the sword. Okay. Let's try that paragraph again. So this is the one that was burned. She grabbed at his arms, holding them in place and struggling against him as he put all his weight on his blade. With all her strength, she managed to force the sword back and punch him in the face with his hilt. She did it again, and he screamed as she impacted heavily against his already damaged and mangled face. As they struggled, the swordsman slowly began to twist the blade so that it would point towards her, but she gave all her strength to turn it back around on him. She was definitely stronger than him, and she managed to get the blade tip pointed directly at his face, but his whole weight was still on her, and with all his weight, he was keeping her from thrusting the sword forward. So instead, she gave way, letting her arms go loose and allowing the handle of the sword to impact her chest hard like a punch. It hurt, but she then used her own body, pulling herself up and thrusting forward with her entire body to stab the sword up and through the swordsman's face and out the back of his skull. He collapsed on top of her, and she rolled his limp body aside, even as she heard bandits from another fire pit talking to each other.
I swear I heard something like a scream from over there,
one voice said. Lin spotted a bucket of water beside the fire pit and quickly grabbed at it, pouring it over the fire to douse out the flames before everyone in the camp noticed Lin and all the bodies she'd compiled. 4 dead so far. Technically 6, but 2 of them she hadn't known about beforehand, and thus didn't count towards her total of 30. That meant 26 more bandits to go.
Did you see that?
The voice said again.
I didn't see nothing,
someone else said.
That's because the fire went out,
the first voice said.
I'm telling you that something is happening over there and we should check it out.
She could see the figure of the person talking as he grabbed a flaming log from his fire pit, and the two of them started for Lynn's position.
"We'll be back in a moment,"
one of them said to someone else around their fire. As the two men approached, Lynn quickly used her cover of darkness to collect all her weapons, wiping the axe heads clean before hooking them in the loops of her jacket. Her daggers went back into their bandolier. Her daggers quickly wiped clean as well, were stowed back into their bandoliers. Let's try that paragraph, see if that works. As the two men approached, Lynn quickly used her cover of darkness to collect all their weapons, wiping the axe heads clean before hooking them in the loops of her jacket. Her daggers, quickly wiped clean as well, were stowed back into their bandolier.
"It's pitch black!"
The one bandit said. My computer's like, "Sure you don't mean the other it's, but I mean, it is pitch black, so that works, right?" That's how you know whether or not it, you know, it's an apostrophe S on it's if you can separate it is, and the sentence still works. So I mean, I don't know why my computer's being dumb.
"It's pitch black,"
the one bandit said, moving away from the one with the torch and drawing a sword. They were circling the fire now, almost on top of her, as she pulled her small knife from the scrawny bandit's neck and wiped it on the grass before sliding it into her boot and diving silently into Terry's tent as the torch cast light onto her position. Inside, she grabbed the canteen from earlier and poured the liquid all over the sleeping bag. As the man with the torch got close to her tent, she jumped out from the tent with a sleeping bag, smothering the torch with wet fabric and smothering... Poop. Try that sentence again. Inside, she grabbed the canteen from earlier and poured the liquid all over the sleeping bag. As the man with the torch got close to her tent, she jumped out from the tent with the sleeping bag, smothering the torch with the wet fabric as she tackled the man to the ground. Pulling her knife from her boot, she stabbed it into the side of the man's head, killing him instantly. The nearby bandit with the sword had only seen a sudden movement and then darkness.
"What is that?"
he started to say, stepping close to Lynn. Before he could finish his question, she swung out her leg and tripped him, pulling a throwing axe from under her jacket and embedding it inside of his head as he hit the ground.
"Guys?"
called a third person from the nearest fire, watching out after his buddies and now seemingly concerned at their sudden disappearance. He turned around to those camped at his large fire.
"Guys?"
he said again, though in a different context this time.
"I think something's going on."
Two others joined him.
"What do you mean?"
one asked as Lynn watched them from the darkness.
"Callie and Derek just went to check out why that fire went out and they disappeared."
I don't know why he's sending a golden.
"And they disappeared."
The first guy explained. The second guy put his hands on his hips.
"They're probably just playing a game on you."
"Should we check it out?"
the third person asked. The first bandit, the youngest of the group, shook his head.
"One of us should probably set off the alarm first,"
he suggested smartly. The second bandit shook his head.
"What are you, scared?"
I'll do it.
Oh, I can't remember what the third guy's voice was. The third person said quickly. She couldn't let them spread alarm across the camp, or this was going to get a lot harder. She broke into a sprint, running through the darkness across the camp towards them. One of them, the third one, could just make out her dark form in the dim light from his fire.
What the?
The man began to say. Before he finished getting his words out, Lynn had her throwing daggers in her hands and threw them into the heads of Bandit 2 and 3 on either side of the first one. He looked back and forth between his friends in shock as they dropped. Lynn, jumping out of the shadows, had body tackled him to the ground. She wrapped her arms around the young kid's neck, the boy seeming no older than late teens, and snapped it painlessly. She looked up and quickly glanced around to make sure no one else had seen anything, breathing heavily as she was desperate for a moment's rest. But one didn't come, as someone had seen her take down those three. The blacksmith. The large, bald man with bulging muscles and a handlebar mustache glared at her with eyes wide in anger. Lifting a large two-handed hammer from beside him, the head of the hammer bigger than his actual head and looking considerably heavier, too, he lifted his weapon over his head and screamed. Charging in at her, he brought his hammer down heavily on top of her as she dodged nimbly to the side. The hammer impacted against the ground heavily with a loud choom. And Lin tried to sidestep around the large man, but he lifted his hammer up and threw it wide. The head of the hammer just nicked her as she tried to dodge it, and she was thrown off her feet and into the heavy metal anvil. It hurt more than she tried to let on.
Hey!
Someone yelled. Someone else in the camp yelled.
Austin is firing someone!
She assumed Austin must have been the blacksmith. A couple others joined the first, and they all began watching and cheering.
Go, Austin!
This absolutely wasn't going as planned. Austin the blacksmith charged in on her, swinging his hammer to the side and then over his head to bring it down on her, but she quickly jumped backwards and planted her back on the anvil to roll over it onto the other side. The hammer came down on the anvil between them with a loud resounding thoom, metal, thoom. Some were like, "Ping!" Before he could lift it off the anvil, she grabbed the hand with both hands between his grip and tried to pull it free. He wouldn't budge, and she let herself fall back, planting both her feet on the anvil to pull at his hammer with both her entire body weight and the strength of her legs. Still, Austin wouldn't let go of his hammer, but the pull was too much for him, and he was yanked forward to smash his face off the dense anvil. He was stunned, shaking off the pain and pulling back with all his might. Like him, she didn't let go, but allowed him to lift her into the air again, only to press her feet against the anvil and do the same move a second time. This time, she slammed his face into the anvil even harder than the first, and in his daze, he finally let go of his hammer. She swung it out and over, and then brought it down on top of Austin's head, crushing his skull against the anvil and splattering the anvil with his brains. There. Or you could just say it. Everyone watching and cheering, now five of them in all, stopped their celebrating in somber realization at the seriousness of what was going on. Two of them drew swords. One of them finished drinking from his flagon and threw it on the floor. The hammer really was as heavy as it looked, a strain in her hands, but not an unwelcome one. The gash in her one hand was bleeding all over the handle, though. The gash in her one hand was bleeding all over the handle, though, making it slippery in her grip. As four of the five spectating bandits charged forward at her. Swinging her hammer up into the side, she struck the bandit furthest to her left with a blow so hard she heard his ribs shatter in his chest as he ragdolled into the guy beside him with a sword. The two of them dropped to the ground as the third one came in with his sword swinging. She spun the hammer in her hands, wielding it more like a top-heavy quarterstaff. She deflected his sword away with the head of her hammer once, and then twice, spinning the hammer in her hands as he came in from multiple directions. The fourth one, unarmed, jumped forward as if he was about to do something, but Lin didn't give him a chance. She clubbed him in the balls with the handle of her hammer, and as he leaned over in pain, she swung her hammer horizontally and broke his spine at the neck as her hammer bent his head completely parallel with his shoulders. He dropped, but he didn't even have a moment, as she had to turn back to the swordsman and deflect another swing of his sword.
"You're gonna pay for that,"
the man growled, and she supposed he didn't need to know about the other 12 of his friends she'd already killed. He threw his sword wide to sash in again. That apparently is only move. And this time Lin threw her hammer forward with all her might to slam into the swordsman's chest. The bandit was thrown off his feet onto his back, wheezing desperately with two collapsed lungs. At Lin's feet, one of the bandits still stirred, and she dropped the hammer on top of his chest, the man's arms flailing up into the air at the impact and then going limp. But Lin was already searching her surroundings, her eyes seeking out the fifth bandit who had been watching. Had retreated instead of rushing forward with the others. There we go. But Lin was already searching her surroundings, her eyes seeking out the fifth bandit who had retreated instead of rushing forward with the others. There was a quiet sound, like a thwip, and Marilyn managed to bring her hammer up just in time to block an arrow fired off from her left. The arrow shaft splintered against the large head of the hammer, and Lin traced her gaze back across the arrow's trajectory to an empty tent where the bandit had pulled a bow and quiver of arrows. He fired a second shot as Lin started towards him, and Lin effortlessly held her hammer up to block it. The bandit fired a third shot, and she blocked it again, her pace quickening this time. The bandit gave up shooting at her, pulling out a white horn and putting it to his lips. She couldn't let him blow his horn, but she wasn't close enough to reach him. He began blowing,
the horn blaring out around the camp, and Lynn threw out her hammer with all her might, releasing her grip and letting it soar loose and take the bowman clear off his feet and into the empty tent. But the damage had been done. Even if the horn had only blared for a moment, she could hear people turn their attention her way and ask each other what was going on. People were going for their weapons. Sorry, I knocked my thing. Sorry if that made weird noises. People were going for the weapons. Marilyn grabbed the bow from the last bandit she'd killed, the young man tangled up in the tent and not moving, and carried the quiver of arrows to the nearest fire pit where she planted them into the ground beside her. The quiver of arrows. Being close to the blacksmith's anvil, she spotted some, where she planted it then. Not them, because she's planting the quiver of arrows, not the arrows. Marilyn grabbed the bow from the last man she'd killed, the young man tangled up in the tent and not moving, and carried the quiver of arrows to the nearest fire pit where she planted it into the ground beside her. Being close to the blacksmith's anvil, she spotted some tanning leather strips hanging from a rack and grabbed one. Pulling an arrow from her quiver at her feet, Lynn quickly wrapped her arrow with the leather as the camp around her continued to grow more alert. No one, it seemed, had noticed her yet. She spotted one bandit start to come out of his tent, and she placed her arrow in the fire, setting it alight before putting it in her bowstring and firing it at the man. She hit him square on, and he fell back into his tent that quickly lit ablaze. She grabbed a second arrow and began wrapping it in the leather hide, lighting it and firing her burning arrow into a second tent she knew was occupied. She could hear the screams of the man inside as she continued wrapping her third arrow, lighting it and firing it into a third tent. The bandits in the camp were really panicking now as their tents were bursting into flames, and one bandit out in the open with a two-handed axe in his hand spotted Lynn. Two-headed axe. I meant that two-headed axe. You know, like on either side. Two-headed axe in his hand spotted Lynn. She spotted him too, and her next arrow she didn't even bother lighting it on fire. She put it on her string and fired it through the man's eye. He dropped where he stood. Immediately, she was back to wrapping another arrow, lighting it, and firing it into another tent.
She's got a bow!
Someone yelled out, and she could see across the large fire pit beside her, someone who had locked eyes on her, much as the guy with the axe had. She grabbed an arrow from the quiver and fired it across the fire pit to peg the man in the neck as he started to run around at her. There was that familiar sound of a thwip, and an arrow breezed past her head. Spotting the man with the bow, an arrow, he had fired it. What? Alright, so that sentence again. There was that familiar sound of a thwip, and an arrow breezed past her head. Spotting the man with the bow who had shot at her, she knocked her arrow and lit loose, her aim thankfully far better than his. Turning at the heavy sound of footsteps, two bandits were almost on top of her, swords held over their heads in anger. She didn't have time to notch another arrow, and instead she rolled back away from them and grabbed a sword off the floor from one of her earlier kills. This was exactly the sort of chaos she'd wanted to avoid, but she was game to play if they were. The one on the left swung first, bringing his sword down at her, and she swung up to block with her own. The guy on her right moved to cut her arm off, and she quickly spun around to elbow him in the face. He halted the downward trajectory of his sword as he was momentarily dazed, then tried instead to stab with it at her head. He halted the downward trajectory of his sword as he was momentarily dazed and tried to instead stab with it at her head. She managed to bring her sword around to knock his aside and just miss her. Then she tackled herself into the first bandit before he could take enough steps back to get a decent swing on her. As long as she stayed close to them, they wouldn't be able to pull off an attack. She grabbed the first man's sword arm, then swung him between her and the second bandit as the man moved in with a jab. He ran his friend right through, eyes wide in horror at what he'd done.
"That was you," Lynn told him, getting the man's sword free and wielding both her swords through there.
The second bandit pulled his sword free and seemed about to come in at her, but she had to dodge back to avoid a third bandit's heavy two-sided axe. The third bandit, with a longer bushy beard to his belly button, brought his axe up at her, and she knocked it aside with her left sword. She then brought her right sword down on him for a killing blow.
but the second bandit blocked it with his sword.
Don't you think you've done enough?
Lin goaded him, backing up as they both advanced on her. She deflected the axe to her right as it came down at her from the left, bringing up her right blade to block the sword. So it came from the left, she deflected it right with her right blade. She raised her right blade up to block the sword. Their blades locked. The axe man swung right to her right. So he, even though he's already going right, he throws even more right so he can get more momentum when he swings it around left. The axe man swung right to her right, then brought his axe around to her left, trying to take her out at the torso. You guys get it now. She brought her left sword down to block his axe with the flat of her blade, but the impact still knocked her off her feet. She rolled a couple meters to the feet of two more armed bandits. She sashed out the legs to her left, cutting another guy with a sword literally off at his ankles. He screamed in agony, but she was busy dodging back from the second new bandit, this one swinging a pair of nunchucks. Who in all of Khaldeen walked around with nunchucks? She had to back away as he swung out at her, and the bandit with the sword from before closed in on her, swinging wildly. She blocked his sword with one of her own, then stabbed the other into his gut. She had to pull her sword out fast as the nunchuck man closed in, and she brought her bloody blade up to tangle with his nunchuck as he swung it at her head. She yanked the nunchuck free from his hand with the tangled blade as the man with the axe from earlier came at her once more. He swung at her diagonally, knocking her tangled sword from her hand and forcing her to dodge aside. His axe buried into the dirt, and she put her sword on top of it, locking him from pulling it out long enough for her to pull free her boot knife with her spare hand and cut him up the middle from groin to neck. Their eyes met, as his blood sprayed out from his chest all over her face. He stared into her eyes with horror for just a moment before letting go of his axe and falling forward onto his stomach. Blood oozed out around him. She quickly wiped her knife on the ground and set it back in her boot, rolling back as a nunchuck-wielding bandit swung down at her. She then had to swing her blade up to block the sword of the man she had only just gutted. Behind her, not the one, I can't say that anymore because she gutted another person since then. Sort of the man she had previously run through. There. Behind her, she could hear footsteps. More than one person. It could only be two. She was down to her last five bandits, and she hadn't seen the leader leave his tent. She quickly swung her blade up and cut the man in front of her across the throat. Tackling forward, she surged into the man wielding the nunchucks and ran him through. This time, she made sure to twist her blade before throwing him off of her and turning to face her last two attackers. These last two were wielding swords like hers, though the one on the left had a larger two-ended blade. The two-ended sword-wielding bandit got to her first, swinging his sword down at her. She deflected it aside with her sword in her right, letting the blade slide off and into the ground instead of trying to bear the weight and potentially get her sword knocked loose. She then fished out one of her hatchets from her under her jacket and caught the second bandit's smaller blade in the crook of her axe. Swinging it aside, she stabbed up with her sword through his chin, much as she had done with Terry. Only this time her blade was longer and went straight through his skull and out the other side. Now it was just the one bandit left. He held up his two-handed sword in a guarded stance, and she threw her axe. She threw her hatchet into the dirt at his feet, holding her smaller sword in two hands and sliding her feet into a sideways stance. They came at each other, the bandit stabbing out at her with his sword, and she pushed it aside with her sword without raising it, turning it horizontal as they passed and slashing him across the stomach. He stumbled forward, holding onto his side and trying to stay on his feet. Lin, however, took a casual step forward herself. Leaning down and grabbing the handle of her hatchet sticking out of the dirt. Straightening, she turned and threw the hatchet at the last bandit as he tried one last valiant charge. Her axe caught him in the face, and he dropped to his knees and then onto his face, which only pushed the axe deeper and out the back. Her axe caught him in the face, and he dropped to his knees. He lingered on his knees for just a moment, before
falling forward onto his face. Forward onto his face, which only pushed the axe deeper and out the back of his skull. Lynn grimaced at the sight, hesitating to retrieve her weapon. Scene change. Bop, 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 bop. Scene change. Bop, 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 bop. Just two.
It's like,
Allison said, the leader of the bandits sitting cross-legged in front of her.
Why are you the leader of your crew?
The boss shrugged, hanging onto her every word.
I killed the man who was supposed to be, who was previously the leader. That's exactly what I'm saying, though,
Ellie said excitedly.
But why was he the leader?
Because you perceived him to be the leader.
And then the moment you stopped perceiving him as the leader, there was a change in the status quo. And now everyone perceives you as the leader.
The boss nodded his head.
Okay. Okay, he said slowly. It's the same with money,
Allison told him.
Exactly the same with money.
She'd kept him talking with her for what seemed like half an hour, even as there were a ton of weird noises from outside. She could only assume it was her mother, but Ali knew her best hope would be to keep the leader distracted as long as she could.
There was quite the ruckus out there,
the leader said in his rich accent. From what she could tell from their half hour of talking, just because he had a rich accent didn't mean he was smart. At all.
You're the one that said your crew was too rowdy,
Ali pointed out to him, figuring she'd use his words against him instead of him needing to take her word for it. He shrugged.
I was right, of course, he told her, and it seemed to quiet down some now. And it seemed to have quieted down some now.
Suddenly the flap to his tent lifted, and Allison's mother stepped inside.
Mom!
Ali said in surprise, realizing that she was covered in blood, some of which was her own.
Mom?
Royal hells! The boss swore, grabbing at Ali's mom's sword, hanging from a mannequin and pulling it loose. He swung his blade around and it rang against her mom's. He then tackled into her, slipping past her as she stumbled into the side of the tent.
She's escaped, you idiots!
The leader yelled into the camp as he ran away from his tent.
Mom,
Allison said, her eyes looking at her with scary cold, her mother looking at her with scary cold eyes. Without saying anything, Ali's mother left the tent in pursuit of the leader.
Wait!
Allison called after her, getting up and chasing her mother from the tent. The sight that awaited her was not what she expected. The camp looked nothing like it had the last time she'd seen it. The tents around her were burning so brightly that she could feel the warmth on her cheeks, and the ground was littered with bodies and blood and guts. Beside the nearest large fire pit, the leader squared off against her mother, Lynn's sword in one hand and Ali's sword in the other.
You killed them all! The leader yelled at her mother. What the hell is wrong with you?
You never should have messed with me. Ali's mom spoke coldly over the roaring flames around her.
Or my daughter. And you definitely shouldn't have killed our horses. They were just fucking horses,
the leader swore, spitting on the ground at her feet.
They meant nothing.
They meant everything to me,
Allison yelled out from a few meters away.
Perceived value, remember?
She said, reminding him of their previous conversation. The leader of the bandits, though now a leader of no one, looked back and forth between them, and then dropped his sword into the dirt and got to his knees.
I'm sorry,
he said, sobbing loudly.
I'm so sorry.
The horses were sorry, too, Lynn muttered back at him, only just able to make out her mother's words even as she got closer. Her mother then lobbed the leader's head clear from his shoulders with her sword and kicked his body into the fire. Ali's mother turned towards her, and the two of them locked eyes.
Mom,
Ali said slowly,
you did all this?
She didn't know if she was impressed or scared. She felt both at the same time.
I will do anything to protect you,
her mother said. And Allison ran into her mother's arms, hugging her tight and sobbing into her shoulder.
They killed Bill,
Ali said, letting her grief wash out. They killed him!
I know,
Lynn said, patting her daughter's head.
I know. Let it out. And then go around and gather whatever supplies you can.
She let go of Ali and bent down to pick up the two blades the leader had dropped.
Here's your sword,
Lynn told Ali, Allison wiping her face on her sleeve and taking the weapon.
Try to hold on to it this time.
Ali's mother looked back at the raging fire.
I think the scabbard was still on him.
Lynn shrugged.
I'm sorry.
Lynn nodded at Ali and started back towards the leader's tent, giving Ali her back.
Now hurry it up. Pack up anything you can. You've got 10 minutes.
And then we're heading back, right?
Allison yelled out after her mom.
Then we're going home?
Her mom stopped and turned around.
If we continue on from here, we can make it to the forest before next sunset.
She stepped forward.
Ali, your uncle depends on us doing this. You said you always wanted to go on an adventure.
I didn't think it would be like this, Allison begged. I didn't think it could go so wrong.
She felt like she was going to start crying again.
I didn't want to be here. I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to do this, Mommy. I don't think I'll like this side of you.
Allison, her mother said sternly, you're 15 years old, not a baby. Start acting like it. Take some responsibility and start collecting up supplies.
She turned her back on her daughter again, leaving Allison feeling embarrassed and foolish, sobbing to herself in the surrounding fire. Finally, she gathered herself enough to yell one more question after her mother.
What are you going to do?
Allison's mother didn't bother looking back as she responded.
I'm going to set fire to the rest of these tents.
Next time on Royalty at Patriot page at 99geek.ca in September 2021. Yes, that's supposed to be 99geek.ca. I guess www.nigeek.ca. Alright. Same with this one. www.nigeek.ca. Alright, cool. Next time on Royalty at 99geek.ca in September 2021. Lynn and Ali arrive at their destination while Dermon begins to recruit and train a militia, and Marius sets out from his forest, beginning his march towards the town of Westerly, and a most fated confrontation. Try that again. Lynn and Ali arrive at their destination while Dermon begins to recruit and train a militia. As for Marius, he sets out from his fortress, beginning his march towards the town of Westerly and a most fated confrontation. Next month, Princess Mirande in the City of Tomorrow at 99geek.ca in July 2021. What does Mirande's brother want with her now? Is he going to want to negotiate, or will she have to prove her innocence? Is there any hope for her to save her people from her brother's tyrannical grip? Or will she be wiped from existence and given a final death, much like her father? Tune in at a new bat time, Mondays, not Sundays, but same bat channel to find out. Or really, I should say tune in to the website, because the podcast is ending. It's over. It's done. Already, I've been getting messages from Podomatic saying that they're going to start deleting my old podcast, which is fine. I'm leaving this one here as like a final goodbye to you. Hope you enjoy. Oh, my internet died. That's interesting. I haven't had my internet die in a long time. Thank God I just recorded this and I didn't bother streaming it as well, which is makes it extra weird that my internet just died. Anyway, that's not important. I was just going to read a thing that now I can't read. So, oh well, but it doesn't matter, because all you need to know is go to 99geek.ca. I'm sorry that this podcast didn't work out. I wish it had built a bigger audience that had stuck around. I wish people had been more vocal. I wish that I could have an audience that appreciated my work and enjoyed tuning back in every week, but I don't think I'm going to find that here. So I'm just going to keep writing for myself and posting on my website and getting shitty numbers and never achieving my dreams and dying alone and miserable and with no friends and family or anything. Life sucks, but what can you do?
That is apparently all you can hope for from life, is to die alone and miserable. Live long and prosper, and may the Force be with you.